it's very hard to kind of look at my career other than just seeing the goal, because the goal has defined me. And people have asked me over the years, would you swap the goal for 500 appearances and maybe an England cap? And, and the truth is, I can't answer it,
no,
the question,
because
I can't look back over my life and think, well, would it have been different? Would I have wanted it different?
Jimmy Glass is best known for a moment in football when, as a goalkeeper, he scored a last-minute goal for Carlisle United in 1999 that kept the club in the Football League. This extraordinary event has turned him into an iconic figure whose story transcends the sport.
I think this podcast is probably different to many others, because many other people have been successful and they're talking about how they were successful. I think in some ways that there's a...
So it's a do-or-die match against Plymouth Argyle, with Carlisle needing to win to stay in the Football League and the game tied at 1-1. You're in goal for Carlisle when Carlisle awarded a corner up the other end of the pitch, some 100 yards away. It's the 5th minute stoppage time. The ref has indicated this is the last play of the game. The stadium announcer even got on the PA and said, we've got 4 minutes to save our football club. Jimmy Glass, what happens next?
It's a great question, Alex. Well framed. That's obviously that question is the one that people ask me and have asked me for the last 25 years. And I think most people in football know what happens next. The guy in red and black runs up the pitch and volleys in the winning goal and saves his football club from being relegated out of the Football League. The backstory of it is that I was there for 3 games on loan. I was a Swindon Town player. There was a bit of... controversy because I'd been signed after the deadline.
Okay, I didn't know that.
So Scarborough, who went down because of the goal, who were our rivals at the time, the other side of the Pennines, they put in a complaint because I was there. They thought illegally, but actually they'd all voted. All the football clubs had voted. I think 92 of them had voted the year before that after the transfer deadline, if a goalkeeper gets injured, they can sign. A club can sign another goalkeeper because it's a specialised position.
Mm.
So that's what happened. I scored a goal and kept him in the Football League. The reality of that situation probably started, if I'm truly honest, the story started, I'd say, some 20 years earlier when I was playing in the Cub Scouts.
I remember playing for the Cub Scouts.
The 4th Worcester Park Cub Scout pack. And it's my first ever experience of playing football for a team when I was... They put me in goal first because I showed, you know, promising goal. I was only about 7 years old. So it would have been 18 years earlier because yeah, I was 25 when I scored for Carlisle. And basically, I played for a year for the Cubs, but then after a year for the Cubs, I went up front. And essentially, throughout my entire career... And definitely when I finished, I never knew if I was a goalkeeper or a centre forward.
Really?
In reality, that's the truth of my life and my football career. And when I say I never knew, I wasn't particularly brilliant at both or either, but it was something I really enjoyed. And I love playing up front as much as I love playing in goal. And my natural instincts are both... kind of helped me to A, save goals and also B, score goals. So on that day, on the 8th of May 1999, when the ball fell to my right foot on the 6-yard line, for me, there was only going to be one outcome because the day before in training, I barely put my gloves on. I'd run around up front in the 5-a-sides and scored a hat trick. And that was a general sort of picture of my young footballing career.
So it was like second nature when the ball dropped that you just...
Yeah, it sounds brash, but I suppose you got to back yourself. And if I'm truly honest, I was probably more confident at scoring goals than I was at saving them.
Really?
Because there's much less pressure.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So I enjoyed it more. So that's why at different times in my career when I probably wasn't achieving what I'd hoped I would for various reasons, but, you know, that I always enjoyed going and playing up front. And when I was a young footballer at Palace, when I wasn't involved in the matches because for one reason or another, I'd go and play as a ringer on Sundays for my friend's team sometimes and go and score goals on Sunday mornings. I just loved it. I just loved it. And that day when the ball fell to me, like I said, there was only one outcome really.
And Red, there's a great documentary at Sky recorded with you. Is it true that Nigel Pearson, the manager at the time, let everyone have a brandy in the change room to kind of calm the nerves beforehand? Or is that one of those folklore stories that have come out of that?
Do you know the crazy thing is, it was a really surreal situation. You know, Carlisle United had been in the Football League for 71 years. They were a sleeping giant in many kind of minds. You know, at one stage in 1974, they were top in the old First Division.
Were they?
You know, they would regularly get probably 8,000 fans, you know, even in what was then the third division, but the bottom league. Yeah, you know, they're a big club with a lot of history and a lot of passion. So the first thing I noticed when I got into Carlisle 3 weeks before was that how kind of the town was so resigned to failure. But, you know, the chairman at the time, Michael Knight, and many thought had really drained the club into the ground and the town were really low with their club. And they didn't really have great expectation and hope that they would stay in the league. And certainly that morning when I was driving into the ground, that was the feeling that was around. So Nigel Pearson, literally fresh out of playing, literally just stopped. You know, he had a young team, and many of them were Cumbrians. Many of the squad, which is very unusual now, but at the time were born and bred from Carlisle or the surrounding areas. So he realised that he had to do something different. He had to try and take the pressure off. And I think that he had a meeting before I got there. He had a meeting with the team, and I wasn't at the meeting because ultimately I knew I was playing. He hadn't told the rest of the players who was playing, but I was the only fit goalie, so I knew I was playing. And at that meeting, he sort of said to him, "You know, this is it. You got an opportunity now. They had to win the game. You know, do it whichever way you see fit.
Yeah.
Get yourself ready mentally whichever way you see fit." And I'll be honest, in the changing room before the game, there was a bottle of brandy being handed around and people were taking swigs of the brandy. Now, by today's sports science standards,
yeah.
You know, they'd be having kittens.
Yeah.
But the game was very different then and it was a very different mentality. And it's true. That was the mindset that Nigel had at the time. It was, you've got to win this game in whichever way you can.
And before you know it, you're being carried off the pitch, having scored the winning goal and ended up getting a knee in the head, I think, as well. Is that right?
Well, immediately after I scored, there was a massive pitch invasion. Now, when I always had dreams of scoring a league goal, obviously, you know, I tell you, I was a frustrated forward. So, you know, you think you're going to run off to the corner flag, you know, you're going to run the length of the pitch with your arms in the air, you know, all these visions go through your mind as to what you would do. But literally, I had an opportunity to turn, I think, raise my hand in the air, and then the whole team just, they jumped on me. And then we all fell to the ground. And David Brightwell, who was the captain, was at the bottom of the pile with me. And then suddenly his pile just got heavier and heavier and heavier to the point we couldn't breathe. We were stuck on the bottom of this month. And when you look back on the videos, there was probably 50 people on top of us.
Oh, my God.
You know, the referee got wiped out as well in the melee. That there was a mass pitch invasion. Like, every fan that was in the ground ran onto the pitch. So in that bundle, I got a knee to the face. So I got up and I was a bit jaded and my nose was bleeding. And there was just this sea of people across the pitch. Now, I didn't realise that the game literally was over. When the captain was running into the box, the ref said, "This is it," basically. And I thought there'd be a couple of minutes left. So I was trying to steady myself. So I've just scored. I've just been bundled. The crowd's going crazy. And I'm trying to steady my nerves and steady myself to get back to my goal. So I thought there was a couple of minutes left. So I was thinking, right, you've got to calm down because you've got, you know, I mean, I was dizzy and all sorts going on. I was just trying to calm myself down. I didn't realise. I got back to my goal, tried to look for my towel that you normally leave when you go. Someone had nicked it. So I've got this blood coming out of my nose. And I didn't really see that all the other players in the opposing team were in the centre circle. So the referee had already warned them. So they rolled the ball forward for the kickoff, and then the referee blew the whistle. Okay. But the thing is, I was the furthest one from the tunnel.
Yeah.
And I was the one they all wanted. So, you know, trying to get off the pitch then when they literally were coming from all angles. And I got hoisted up and carried off by thousands of Cumbrian Carlisle fans. It was a real surreal moment. You can't. It's very hard to describe those moments, and they obviously don't happen very often in your life. So that's all elation.
Yeah.
It was a great moment in my life.
And at the time of recording this, we're coming up to 25 years, literally to the day. How do you look back on it now, given the breadth of time? Do you look back on it fondly or otherwise?
It's a real mixed bag for me, this goal. My life, for various reasons, hasn't been plain sailing. And my football career, especially, it's had quite a few ups and downs, more downs than ups, in truth. I never really truly fulfilled my potential as a goalkeeper, which I was very aware of for a long time, and it's something I had to reflect on. After I stopped playing football, I had many years sat in my taxi to think about the game and what happened. When I initially stopped playing, I was quite bitter and resentful about the game and about the people in it. The goal was always there. It felt like an albatross.
Did it?
For a period. Certainly after I scored for a couple of years, when my career started to struggle. Because on one hand, I'm this famous goal-scoring goalkeeper. You know, it's in the 100 great sporting moments, the goal and things like that. But on the other hand, I couldn't seem to settle anywhere or get a game or a club that I wanted. And I was willing to go down the leagues. I was willing to just play football. But it just didn't work out for me. So for many years, I kind of had a mixed emotions towards the goal. On one hand, I enjoyed it because it was a fantastic moment. Who wouldn't? But on the other hand, in some ways, it kind of turned my career into a circus after I scored. And then ultimately, a couple of years later, I'm out of football. And then, realistically, I'm so far out of football within a short space of time and stay for many years away from it. But then I'd still... Even driving my taxi around Wimborne, where I have my taxi business, I'd still get calls from Sky who want to come and interview me about something, and they'd be sat in my taxi driving around the streets. It was a really strange existence for me. I'd be sat listening to the World Cup, and Brazil would be playing Colombia, and next thing you know, a keeper runs up, and the commentator saying, "Oh, he's doing a Jimmy Glass," and I'm sat there in my taxi on a rank, thinking, "Well, this is all a bit."
I was going to say, how do you piece those bits together?
The truth is, you don't, and I didn't. And towards the end of my football career, I picked up a gambling habit, you know, because I think by modern day standards, mental health issues. But essentially, I didn't really understand the game mentally. We didn't have what player liaisons like I've just spent the last 8 years at Bournemouth trying to help players, and what we didn't have people there to kind of settle you down and look at things and try and help you understand the situation. So it was, for many years, it was a struggle. And then the gambling, when I fell out of football, and I had twins on the way very quickly, and life kicks in very quickly. You know, I struggled for many years to find myself and find my place in the world. But then I'd have this goal. So every now and again, you dress yourself up in some suit and go and do something there, everyone's cheering your name. It was a strange existence for many years.
Yeah, and especially, as you say, when you end up going back into football at AFC Bournemouth with Eddie Howe, and we'll definitely revisit that. But I'm interested to talk a little bit about vision then, and going back to when you first became a professional footballer, was there a plan? Was there a vision as to this is what I would like to achieve in my career? Where did you see yourself?
Well, I think football back when I started was very different. You know, the money wasn't in it. So your top Premier League footballers would only be earning, you know, I say only, but you know, £1,000, £2,000 a week, which, you know, £100,000 a year back in the 90s was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it's not going to change your, it's not going to create a life for you. You have to literally have a 15-year career, play for your country, you know, to maximize the money that you get. It started to expand a little bit more into the sort of mid to late 90s. But when we started playing, it wasn't for the money. I think personally, knowing myself as a child now and having to do a bit of work and understanding myself, it was for the glory for me.
Yeah.
You know, I just loved making saves and people going, wow, I'm clapping. Or scoring goals and people going, wow, I'm clapping. I just love that part of it. And I think that, you know, I talked about mental health issues. Ultimately, I suppose in some ways I was quite insecure as a youngster.
Mm.
Even though I was quite tall and big and strong and good at football, I was quite insecure for various reasons. So I enjoyed the glory of it.
Yeah.
Which is fine. There's all different reasons to play sport. If you love a bit of glory.
Yeah.
And it propels you on to work hard. And in the early years, I did work hard. And I did, you know, I'd be playing four or five times a week. And when I got taken on at Palace as a YTS trainee, I'd be the last one to leave because I'd be scrubbing the floors and cleaning out the toilets. You know, I'd be staying on coaching the academy kids into the evenings. You know, I'd put a lot of effort in and showed, come games, I was, you know, big and strong and could perform. And that's why in the early stages of my career, I was really well thought of. And I was a great prospect.
Yeah.
I think eventually, though, when you get a couple of hits, and I had a couple of injuries, I had some big injuries. I had a double scaphoid break when I was 18. I'd just come out of the Palace youth team. And we won the league. We got to the FA Youth Cup final in 1992 against the Manchester United team of 92. I played in that final.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
But that season, I broke one of my scaphoids in my left wrist, probably around about October time maybe, and they didn't pick it up. And then I broke the other one around about January time. They didn't pick it up. So I finished that season with two broken scaphoids. But it was a phenomenal season. But then I didn't play for 20 months after that.
Wow.
Fortunately, I just signed a new 3-year professional contract, so it gave me time to get fit. And then when I got fit, eventually, I got myself back into the frame. I was number two as a 21-year-old lad in the Premier League behind Nigel Martin, who was a Palace keeper at the time. Again, showing great promise. And then tore my cartilage and didn't play 4 months. And it just seemed...
Stop start.
It was, and it wasn't through any wrongdoing of my own. I worked really hard at that stage. But then eventually I need to get away from Palace because I need to play football, and that's what brought me to Bournemouth.
Right.
But in all honesty, at that stage, it still wasn't about money. We didn't earn, you know, I was probably earning £500 a week at the time, you know, and again, that money's not going to set you up for life.
No. When you went back to Bournemouth, do you see a difference in the attitudes of the players? You know, the last few seasons, those who were doing it for glory, those who were just doing it for the money, those who are doing it for a little bit of both or other reasons?
Well, in my time out of the game, so I probably had 13 years as a footballer, professional in one way or another, and then 13 years out of the game. Because I always considered myself a footballer even when I was driving a taxi, because that's all I knew from 15 to about 28. But then I was getting closer to being a taxi driver longer than I've been a footballer.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was starting to panic about, does that mean I have to call myself? And there's nothing wrong with being a taxi driver, but kind of the thought in my head, I wasn't sure where I was going. And then when the opportunity arose, and it was an opportunity from my doing, really, to go back into Bournemouth. And essentially, I'd over a period of time, I'd kicked my gambling habit, and I had a business, taxi business in Wimborne. It was okay, you know. I got to play golf a couple of times a week. My life had settled down. I could determine my own hours. The opportunity arose to go into Bournemouth and do the hospitality hosting, and only by chance, a friend of mine invited us to the game once, and we went to watch Bournemouth play Blackburn Rovers when they're in the Championship, their second season when they got promoted. And just by chance, talking to Rob Mitchell, the commercial director, I he offered me the position of hosting. And that gave me a season when they their first year in the Premier League to go back in and look at what was going on. And I did, and this player liaison role, and I'll get to your question in a second about what, how players change, because it's important that this player liaison role was a new role in the game. It wasn't there when I was there.
Right.
And ultimately, after a few conversations with Ed, and Ed knew me as a different character when I was younger, probably a bit more brash, which wouldn't have suited Ed and the way he did things. But I think he could see that I changed. So I went in, and now I'm looking at these new footballers, these new players, and they are very new. The mindset of a footballer had changed dramatically. When I grew up, it was, you know, get drunk and run it off the next day. These guys now, they start at a very young age. And if you don't show that you have the capability of managing A, your emotions, and not always, but generally, and B, the professionalism that you need to show for the physical side, the mental side, emotional, as I mentioned, you know, you're not going to get very far in the modern game. So the new type of football is very different. You'll get occasionally a couple slip through who have just got so much ability that they can't be ignored. But generally speaking, they'll fail eventually.
Yeah.
Because the money's very different now. You need to sign one contract at championship level and you're probably set for life.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, one contract championship level now, and you could, by everyone else's standards in the world, you're set for life.
Right.
You get to the Premier League, then it's a different, it's just a different world. You're now becoming the elite from a financial point of view.
Yeah.
So in order to maintain that, your mindset has to be very strong. You have to try and avoid all the things that can take that away from you. You know, all the negative aspects of probably footballers in my day, the gambling, the drinking. You know, the modern day footballer, it doesn't affect them as much, I'd say. That being said, there's still things they don't get. They're still young men.
Yeah.
And they still need help trying to understand certain elements of their lives and help them to manage themselves. Some are better than others. Some need a lot more help than others. But yeah, I'd say that modern football is very, very different. And they have to be, because the rewards are very, very, very different.
Yeah. In a sports documentary by Sky, you say that football gave you a moment. Were there any other moments? Obviously none to that, because nobody, the average footballer in their career doesn't have a moment like that. But was there anything that came close to that for you, or was that literally just out there?
Like I said, I was lucky. I played in the 92 FA Youth Cup final against Beckham and Giggs and Butt and Gary Neville and Keith Gillespie, Robbie Savage.
Yeah.
You know, that was their team.
Who was in your team from that people would know?
Well, this is the point. The irony of the whole thing is that out of the 11 players that started for United, only one of them didn't go on to play football at a high level. Out of the Palace team that started, only two of us did.
Right, okay, wow.
And that's kind of it shows how good Manchester United were and how good Alex Ferguson was in to be able to bring through young talent. So that was a real high point of my young footballing career, obviously, to play Manchester United in the FA Youth Cup final over two legs at Selhurst and at Old Trafford. I went to Wembley with Bournemouth in 1998. They're at their only time at the old Wembley in the auto windscreen final. There was 60,000 plus people at Wembley that day. Bournemouth took about 33,000 people.
Most people don't get to play at Wembley in any
So most people don't get to play at Wembley. and also I played at the old Wembley, which is the iconic 1966 World Cup Wembley.
Yeah.
And then the funny thing is that apparently I scored an own goal according to the Ruffins yearbook. So I think I could be the only goalkeeper in history to score an own goal at the old Wembley as well. But I mean, if you ever see the goal, I think you'll understand it's probably a bit harsh. But then again, a few years later, I sat in my taxi, I took it.
Yeah, exactly.
Mike, I didn't fulfil my potential. I didn't play at the level I probably should have and could have. And that was purely down to me. And it was down to the fact that I wasn't equipped psychologically to understand what was in front of me.
And that's mindset. And
yeah, it's because in reality, everything in life's about mindset.
Yeah.
You know, and if you're lucky, then you've got that kind of tied in quite early. And I suppose lucky is probably the wrong word. People are different. You know, you get some people can cope with certain things and some people who can't. People's lives and what happens to them in their youth can affect their mindsets and their perception of things. There's all different things that affect your mindsets. We can go into a massive psychology conversation, but yeah. But what I did learn is that I'm a very sensitive character. You know, if I always call it a Richter scale out of 10, I'm a number 10. You know, I always use an analogy where you've got, if a number one would be someone could walk into a room of people crying and not notice. Whereas a number 10 would know before he got in the building. And I'm that sort of character. So I used to take on all the emotions of the situation. And in sport, there's lots of emotions being pumped around.
God, yeah.
And certainly in sport that I grew up in, it was very emotional.
Mm.
You know, there'd be people pinned against dressing room doors and trays of tea flying around the place. And
I could say, how do you deal with that environment if you are a, you know, sensitive character and you've got the usual kind of banter and...
Well, that's the thing, because... And where, what happened to me was, and this is what I kind of learned later on, I created a character.
Yeah, okay.
When I was young, I created a character, kind of a loud, bolshy character,
hmm.
that in the early years got me through on the back of my ability as well.
Hmm.
But the reality is when you get about 25, which is what I was when I scored, you've got to end up being the final product. You've got to be the one that can be, certainly as a goalkeeper, you know, calm and composed. And be able to take the criticisms that come your way unfairly, probably a lot of the time.
Mm.
But even, you know, if they're fair, you've got to be able to take those criticisms and you've got to be able to still have confidence in yourself. And they're the things I didn't have. So that's when the cracks started to appear, when about 25.
Right.
But, you know, it's very hard. It's very hard to kind of look at my career other than just seeing the goal. Because the goal was to find me.
Yeah.
And people have asked me over the years, would you swap the goal for 500 appearances and maybe an England cap and, you know, a boat in the south of France? And of course I would know. and the truth is I can't answer it.
No,
the question,
because
I can't look back over my life and think, well, would it have been different? Would I have wanted it differently?
It's what ifs as well, isn't it? It's like no one knows.
Well, yeah, I suppose it comes down to how you value it. And the truth is if all I've done in my football career ultimately is score a goal that's got the kind of the kudos and the fame that the goal I scored for Carlisle has, then ultimately I've got to be grateful.
And the fact, I think, of the enjoyment and what that meant to all of those people from not just watching that game there, but for that town for years and years afterwards.
Well, this is the bit really, and Eddie always used to laugh at me when I said this. He used to take the mickey out of me. But in reality, it wasn't my goal. It was a goal I scored, but the goal represented much more than me and my journey and my life. It represented Carlisle, its history, the 10,000 fans that were in the ground that day, and probably 100,000 in the town. It represents the beauty of the game and also the misery for the Scarborough fans. Scarborough went out of existence 7 years later.
Did they?
You know, so...
Wow.
It just shows why football is such an amazing sport. And not just the technical basics of football, 11 v 11, but the passion that it invokes.
Yeah.
And I remember the day I scored, and one of the things that has always stuck with me is the change. You could feel, again, I'm quite emotional, so I could feel, but you feel that the misery and despair and depression and anxiety in Brunton Park for 10,000 people, the sheer horror of what's about to happen to them in their lives. And people love football. It lifts them. It gives them joy. But it can also hurt you. But that, in an instant, you know, the change from sheer misery to sheer elation. And even for 10,000 people, you know, there's bigger stadiums and imagine it for 100,000 people. But in my experience, that's the bit that I remember most.
Yeah.
Just the change, the feeling in the ground, to just sheer joy and happiness. That's something that'll always stick with me.
And that's the beauty of any sport, isn't it? The drama that it brings, the characters, the plot, the plot twists.
Yeah, exactly. And like you say, that's the beauty of any sports. But there is something about football. It really is the global sport. I know people don't like admitting it, but it's, you know, £7 billion or whatever the TV money is, you know.
Yeah.
I had this conversation quite often. And the reality of it is, I had it last week, sat down with some of the guys from the local rugby club as well, and we were talking about the different opportunities in the town. The truth of the matter is, football is a massive sport. It brings revenues that are unmatchable. And that's why it's the beautiful game, as Pelé called it.
It did. And tell us, what happened in the immediate aftermath of that goal for you, like professionally and personally?
So in the immediate aftermath, it's quite surreal, obviously. I'd gone from being an on-loan goalkeeper from Swindon Town, suddenly thrust into the media spotlight. Immediately after the game, whisked upstairs to go and speak to all the journalists from all the papers that were waiting there patiently just to speak to me. When I look back on it now and I see my interviews and hear my interviews, I wince, because I sound so awful. I just sound so bad. Some cocky little London goalkeeper. Well, not little, but cocky London goalkeeper. But you don't know what to say in those situations. You know, like I said, I was only young. I wasn't media trained.
No.
After 25 years of talking about it, obviously you'd go back and say a few things a bit differently. But in the media, straight after, I'm doing interviews. It was at the time, and this is a strange story. At the time, I was going out with a girl from Wimborne, funnily enough. Her parents lived out the back of Wimborne. and we'd been going out for probably about 18 months at this stage, and it was coming to an end. Nice girl, but just was coming to an end. She was living with me in Swindon. And my plan the next day was to go and see her. Sorry, straight after the game, I was meant to be driving to Nottingham to see her. She'd been working in Nottingham. But then obviously scored, and everyone's going out that night, and there's a meal in a restaurant underneath a nightclub. So I phoned her and I stayed up, and she had the hump with me because I was staying up. And I went out that night, and I remember going back to the hotel and getting a taxi into town. And by that time, after I'd finished all my interviews, I'd gone back to the change room and everyone had gone.
Oh, really?
Like, literally everyone had gone. Like, the apprentices were sweeping up.
Thanks, but...
Well, the apprentices were sweeping up, and then some guys started coming in that were playing, they'd hired the pitch out after the game. Nah. And they come in and started getting changed in the change room. It was really crazy kind of moments, where I didn't really know what was going on. I didn't even know where they were going that night, you know?
Yeah.
And one of the lads told me they were going to Leonardo's. So I went back to the hotel and I spoke to my parents in more depth, and then got dressed, got a taxi down to town. Taxi drivers like asked me random questions about have I had a good day and stuff like that, you know?
You could say that.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, no, it's not been a bad day. So he drops me off and I walk into Leonardo's but I walk in and I don't know what I was expecting. And they weren't celebrating, because the emotional turmoil of the day on everybody involved with Carlisle United Football Club had literally hit at that time. And everyone just sat around and they're having a drink and some people were having a cigar and some of the families were in there. There was a little bit of food handed out, which I missed. And we just sort of sat around. At some point, one of the lads said, "Should we go upstairs to the nightclub?" And there was a back staircase, and we went upstairs, and the doors opened to this nightclub, and I walked in, and this place was absolutely rammed. If you can imagine a nightclub in a northern, about as north as you get, northern town, this place was rammed. And I walked in, and it just erupted. It just erupted.
Yeah.
And I try to walk to the bar and I'm being poured and pulled and kissed, and that's mainly by the blokes. You know, I was trying to get a beer and everyone's trying to put beers in me. And it was just, and I think I lasted about 20 minutes.
Really?
Mm. And then I just snuck out the back door, bouncer opened the back door, I snuck out down, got in a taxi and went back to the hotel and went to sleep. So what should have been and could have been, I suppose, like a pop star night for me,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I let everyone's imagination work out what could have happened. You know, I ended up just kind of going back to my room and going to sleep. Next day, I was driving back down to Nottingham, woke up, had a bit of breakfast, got in my car. And as I was driving through different counties and the different, because this is before digital radios and all these things, and all the different sort of county radios were coming on there, I always got glimpses on the end of the news about, and I thought they were talking about me, but I couldn't quite work out. So I was going back down to Swindon. Actually, I was going to Swindon that day because Brian Burrows, our captain, was retiring, so I was having a drink. And I drove straight down to Swindon from Carlisle, and it's quite a journey, but I got there for the... They were playing Barnsley. And I got there for the second half, and I walked, parked my car, walked into the saw a couple of people in the club, and they're like, oh, Jimmy, well done. And I remember walking up into the stand through the steps, and as I popped my head up, the players that were not playing, and some of them like reserve players, they just looked at me, started laughing, and started clapping. And then as that, all the fans turn around, this whole stand at Swindon, it's a big old stand. And then all the cameramen at the front that were supposed to be taking pictures of the game all turned around and started taking pictures of me in the stand. And it was just surreal.
I bet.
I just wasn't used to it.
Mm.
And I remember after when the game had finished, and Swindon had a poor season. They stayed up, but they had a poor season. I remember walking into the change room after the game, and the manager, Jimmy Quinn, and that's another story, Jimmy Quinn, but ultimately he sent me to Carlisle to foul, so it was quite funny, really, in some ways.
Right.
He'd finished his team talk, and the other players were pushing me in. They said, go in, just walk into the middle. So I walked into the change room, and the first team, and everyone looked at me, and they just started laughing. And I think the assistant manager said, that could only happen to you. That could only have happened to you. And that was, you know, there were nice elements of it where you could just see people enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, players enjoyed it. Everyone enjoyed the goal.
Yeah.
And the people who knew me understood that the sort of thing that I would do. basically I went out for a drink that night. On the Sunday, went up to London to my parents, my girlfriend. And the Monday was quite interesting because I suddenly started getting phone calls from like national newspapers, the Daily Mirror, can you come in? We want to talk to you.
Right.
You know, Piers Morgan was the editor at the time. He wanted to meet, we want to do something. And they did like a double page spread of me like performing miracles. Because I was suddenly the miracle man. And they're like, I'm going to get Al-Fayed's British passport. I'm going to get the royal journalist at the time. I can't remember what his name was, but we're going to get him to eat posh English. Yeah. I'm going to get him to eat a fried breakfast. And there's him there with a fried breakfast. Matthew Wright? I can't remember. There was loads of people who have gone on and been really famous. There's me pictures of the... And then I went there and I went to Sky and did an interview with Sky and I just spent the whole day doing media.
Hmm.
And it's just, again, so unused to it, but they're nice things.
Yeah.
You know, they're nice moments that you get to enjoy. But yeah, that's...
A great story. Didn't know that was going to be the end. To change tack a little bit, you've said that you didn't have a balanced mindset, that you started to gamble to hide the disappointment of your career slipping away. How soon after that did that kind of start happening for you?
Well, it actually started because when I left Palace to come to Bournemouth, I signed a 2.5-year contract and I played under a manager called Mel Machin. The Bournemouth fans will remember Mel.
Yeah.
And Mel was a special kind of character. You know, he had some strange ways about him. And I won't talk badly of him because he's been unwell, Mel. And when I see him now, I shake his hand. I've got no animosity towards him. But my character and his character didn't match. I if I thought something was unfair, it would send me into a spin. And unfortunately, as a goalkeeper, it often is unfair. Mm. And certainly back in those days, you didn't have the analysis that you have nowadays. You know, it was, if someone's mind was made up about a goal, and if you were lucky, the TV cameras might have got that little deflection, but there's no, they probably didn't.
Yeah.
You know, straight away, then the journalist is out there reporting about a mistake that actually didn't happen. And that used to upset me. So I let things upset me. So in my 2.5 years with Mel, it was quite turbulent at times. And I had some good periods and some not so good periods. So it was the Grosvenor Casino that was at the old Royal Bath.
Yeah, yeah.
Was the first time I went into a casino. And before that, I'd never literally put a pound in a fruit machine. Didn't interest me. And I remember going there one night with the assistant manager, John Williams, and a couple of players, and end up turning £40 into £80 playing blackjack or whatever. And I just, and it, like everything in my life, I obviously needed a hole to be filled in some way. And if it wasn't being filled by me playing football or sport and fulfilling that glory that I spoke about earlier, I'd need to fill it in other ways. And that's where gambling came in. So basically, I started gambling in small ways before I scored the goal for Carlisle. But then it really took hold of me afterwards when my career was really failing. Because then you're thinking, well, my career shouldn't be failing now. I'm of this famous goalkeeper. Why can't I get a game? And why can't, you know, and I would play and do well, but it just wouldn't go right. But it was really after I stopped playing football, that's when it takes hold. Because then the real world's on top of you. You know, I had to go out, and after 13 years of being a footballer, I'd never worked in my life. Mm. And very soon after, my girlfriend at the time, she fell pregnant. And next thing you know, I've got twins on the way. And I've got no job, no money, probably gambling debts, probably about 20 grand at the time. No house, you know. Mm. And suddenly I've got twins on the way. So for a few years after, it really took its toll on me.
That sends you into even more of that kind of pressure.
Well, it did in some ways, because gambling for me, I wasn't some degenerate gambler that just go and spend every last penny. I was more of a what we call binge gambler. Mm. So when things would get too much, you try your best and you try and pay the bills and you try and do this and you try and do that and you try and go to that job. But when things would get too much, I'd need to have a release. Mm. But the release would generally be, well, can we go and get a couple of grand to pay this bill or pay that bill? And that's when you're gambling to pay bills, it's the worst type, because you it's a real struggle. On one hand, you're trying to be a good dad and trying to be a good partner or a husband at that stage. But on the other hand, you've got this secret, this dark side of you that is hard to explain to people, because the general consensus of anyone that drinks or gambles or does drugs is, well, it's their own fault, it's this, it's that, they can stop it, you know. But there are... It's generally a symptom. Well, it is a symptom for another problem. Mm-hmm. It's a symptom for a crack in your psyche somewhere. Mm-hmm. So unless you get to the point where you can start fixing that crack in your psyche, whatever it is, then you're never going to be able to control or stop yourself or manage yourself when it comes to the addiction. So it did. It really hit home over a period of years, and I struggled with it. And then gradually started to understand it. And I went down the usual path of going to GA. And I remember sitting there and listening for a few months, and there's a bit of relief kicks in. And this isn't against GA or AA. Whatever people use to manage their addictions is obviously up to them. But for me, that it never really touched on the real issues and the real problems. This whole idea about an addictive personality for me didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. Because to be told you were born kind of broken in some ways, mm-hmm. it just didn't make sense to me. You know, my little brother was born with spina bifida and with physical disabilities. Now, that is broken for me. That's something that can't ever be fixed. Whereas your mind, for me, can be fixed. If you really want it to be, and if you're willing to do the work and look deep enough and find out why. So it took me a period of time, took me a few years, but eventually I got to the mindset where I started to understand myself and what it was. And funny enough, when I stopped gambling, that's when my life started to improve, and not because my money, I had more money, I didn't, I probably had less if I'm honest, but because I started to understand my mind more.
Right.
And it gave me a chance to reflect, on my life and the things I should have done better.
You mentioned before, earlier in our conversation, that that was not luck, but that opportunity, how that opportunity came by. What was it like working with Eddie at Bournemouth?
Well, first and foremost, Ed was a very different character to the one that I knew when he was younger. He was quite quiet. Worked really hard on himself because he, probably by his own admittance, he wasn't the best footballer in the room. But he knew if he worked really hard, he could improve and become as good as he needed to be to have a decent career. So he'd work on his left foot, his right foot. That was his mindset.
Yeah.
So right from a young age of Eddie, it was hard work. You know, it was how can I improve? How can I improve? And that's what led him then, when he started to coach, to understand that you literally have to micro manage everything you're doing to a degree to be the best version of yourself. So when he started coaching the youngsters, the kids, because he didn't have the balls at Bournemouth, he'd go and buy his own bag of balls. He'd have his own markers, so he could then dictate how good a session he was going to put on with the things he could dictate. You can't always dictate how many players you're going to have turn up and what their attitude's going to be. But if you know that you can, and this was Bournemouth's secret, if you know that you can control the things, or manage the things is a better word, psychologists tell you. No, my psychologist, no, we don't control anything, we manage.
Right, okay.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
If you can manage the things that you have the power to manage, then it gets you closer to where you want to be. You can't always determine everything. But for instance, our mindset at Bournemouth, and this is one of the reasons I went back in, was because I completely understood it. When we travelled, you know, what's the best possible way we can travel? How are the players going to be the most comfortable and focused and happy? We couldn't be late anywhere. If we were getting planes, I would go to the airport before, and I learned this from Ed, and Ed taught me a lot of this, although it resonated with me straight away. You know, you'd go, you'd check the airport out, you'd make sure you knew where we were coming in, what desk we were going to. You'd get to a desk before, and you'd say, right, I'm going to have 30 footballers coming through here. Can we do it this way, to give them the quickest transition through the desk?
Yeah.
And the reason behind that, and then you do that with everything, whether you're putting on the Junior Cherries Christmas party at the BIC, what's the best possible way this can go? And the reason for that is because if we're asking these footballers to be the best possible version of themselves, and that was Eddie's mindset and training at all times, you train like you play.
Yeah.
You know, you can't just be a substandard version of yourself Monday to Friday and think you're going to switch it on Saturday. It just doesn't work that way. But then as a staff and as a club, we would have to be as good.
Yeah.
Yeah, when we joined in training, which we did quite a lot.
And your role changed whilst you were there as well, yeah?
Well, I went in as player liaison, but in all honesty, player liaison was a broad term for essentially trying to organise everything off the pitch.
Sounds like,
for Ed.
Yeah.
And joining in training and playing balls in and hitting diagonals and doing all sorts as well, so... And it was good because he was such a hard taskmaster, Ed. If you didn't play the right ball in, he'd come for you. As a member of staff, you had to be perfect. But then why not?
Yeah.
If you're going to be involved in his session, and his session is going to be the best possible version of itself, he needs everyone to be on it. You know. And again, like I said, we would take that into every aspect of how the things we could manage.
Interesting.
Just to kind of clarify, if we're AFC Bournemouth, we've got 11,000 seats, we've got two training pitches, we're in the Premier League. We're going to go to Man City on the Saturday or Anfield or or Man United or Spurs or, you know, ultimately, if you want to write all that down on paper and show what we've got and what they've got, then it's David versus Goliath.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is, if we can manage all the things we can control and we can get ourselves to the best possible version of ourselves, then you reduce the gap between you and these clubs. Now, if on the day those clubs play down a little bit because they're not quite the best version of themselves, you're in the game.
Yeah.
And that was the mindset, and that's what kept Bournemouth in the Premier League for 5 years. Ultimately, it came to an end. You know, I think in truth, Ed had burnt himself out. And he'd worked so hard and he had applied himself so much to the role, being the first one and the last one to leave. I think he got to a point where it was time. He needed that year off.
And then you ultimately decide again that you want to go in a little bit of a different direction, but interestingly, you decide to stay in football, but in a different capacity.
Yeah, so when Ed left, JT left, and the kind of the club as I understood it and knew it had started to change. And this is no reflection on the new owners and the managers, you know, the new managers, no reflection on them. It's just that as I understood things to work, I could see it was going a different direction to me. And I started to look around for opportunities. Didn't really know. I don't want to go and live in Newcastle. Not that Ed would have me anyway. But, you know, I didn't really want to live anywhere else. So it's either down here, at the level I've been at, Premier League level, it's either Bournemouth or nothing else.
Yeah.
But I started to look at different options and what could I do. In the meantime, my wife, Natasha, and I bought a shop in Wimborne. We'd moved to Wimborne. It's ironic, really, if you think I owned Wimborne taxis for years. But
yeah.
Wimborne's obviously got a place in my heart. And I sat down one day with Martin Higgins, who's MSP Capital. They sponsored Bournemouth shirts the year they went back up the second time. And we were talking about various things. I was trying to get him to lend me money to do asset finance for footballers, because what I knew the first time around was every season you stay in the Premier League, footballers start to spend more money.
Yeah.
And they start to buy nicer cars and nicer watches and they start to... But he wasn't interested in that, which I don't blame him. But we had a chat about why he'd bought into Wimborne Town Football Club, because Martin wasn't historically a massive football fan, although his daughter, Harriet, she plays football and loves her football, so he'd started to watch with her. But why has he bought into Wimborne Town Football Club? So I had sat and told him about what I'd done for Eddie in my time at Bournemouth and that it was time for a change for me. And he sat and explained to me why he bought into Wimborne Town Football Club. And in essence, I could see the glint in his eye. You know, it's a friend of mine, Graham Bell, who's a director at Wimborne, had been trying to get me up there for a couple of years to have a look. They've been built a new ground, essentially, as part of the development in Wimborne. With Wyatt Holmes, Davey Wyatt had built Wimborne a new ground. And gifted it to them, or to the council. The council then leased it to Wimborne, and they've got a fantastically long lease on it. And it's just, the more I looked at the club, I just saw this massive opportunity. And not for myself so much, but if I'm truly honest, I do like the idea of being able to help to grow something.
Yeah.
Right from the start. And they've got this fantastic opportunity to be a real force on the South Coast from a non-league point of view. So at the end of that conversation, Martin had offered me a job. We weren't sure what job he'd offered me, but he'd offered me some sort of job. And with a bit of to-ing and fro-ing and discussions, in July, I became the general manager of Wimborne Town Football Club. Now, it's more of a consultancy role, because there's other things I want to work on as well.
Yeah.
But like I said, the opportunity to take a not a young club, because it's been there since 1878 in Wimborne.
Wow.
You know, but to take a club that's got this opportunity to grow, it's got a fantastic stadium, a full-size 3G pitch next to it. And then after, it's funny, after a few weeks of being in there, I phoned Martin. I said, you realise how far this can go, don't you? Because the kind of the... It's limitless to a degree. you know, our plan is to go to National South in the next 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. which is higher than Wimborne's ever been at. I want to try and blend and join us in some way with Bournemouth, because if Bournemouth had a National South Football Club literally a mile, probably not even that, mm. as a crow flies from their new training facility they're building at Canford Magna, it's invaluable to them to be able to develop their young players as well. The synergy for me is just perfect. We've had the development under-21s playing their games at Wimborne this year as well, because of our fantastic stadium. But nice. it's just a fantastic opportunity for me to take everything I learned working with Eddie and JT at Bournemouth, implementing some of my own ideals as well. Mm-hmm. And it's really exciting. And it's funny, because if you said to me, you know, when I was sat in my taxi on a rank in Wimborne over the years, that you'd be running a football club in Wimborne, I'd have laughed at you. I was so far removed from football for such a long time.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed my time at Bournemouth, and I'm really excited and enjoying my time at Wimborne now.
Nice. So look, let's bring things full circle. We're going to do a quick fire round. So short answers, learnings, looking back. First one is going to be, what's the one thing that you needed to screw it, just do it, and get from where you were to where you currently are now?
I think the most important thing, if I can give any advice to anybody, and I don't like giving advice because I don't always see myself as being successful in life, but it's to manage your emotions.
Good one. Like that. Yeah.
If you manage your emotions and you see things clearly as opposed to emotionally, then you've got a much better chance of coming out of it in the right way and making the right decisions.
And what was the one action that you needed to take? So like the big domino that knocked over all the other dominoes?
Do you know, it'd be easy to say to give up gambling. Mm-hmm. But in reality, like I said, gambling was a vice. In all honesty, it's to understand yourself, understand who you are, you know, do the work. Work out what it is and why your perceptions are a certain way, because generally our perceptions are given to us by our upbringing and by our environment.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so sometimes you have to do the work and you have to break them all down and go back to the inner child, as the psychologists call it. But yeah. I can't speak highly enough of it, because sometimes people kind of go back a step and then they go, oh, that's all, but you got to keep going all the way back. Mm. You know, if the wall's a bit wonky, you got to go all the way back to the brick that's first out of place.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you don't, you're always gonna have a wonky wall.
Love it. Are you currently where you want to be?
Am I currently where I want to be? Do you know what? In many ways, yes. There are some things that maybe I'd hoped I'd be slightly different in my life. But you know, you've got to have gratitude. If you every day above ground's a good day.
Yeah.
You know, so if you're working and you've got family, you've got people that love you and you love people and you've got people that respect you and you respect people, then yeah, you've got to be grateful for life. And being involved with Wimborne and having this new challenge is great, and it's a pleasure, and I'm really enjoying it.
Good. How would you like to be remembered for your contributions both on and off the pitch?
Do you know, as a footballer, I still think that football is entertainment. Mm-hmm. It's meant to be entertainment. You know, if you want to go and play on a Sunday morning, it's different. But if people are paying money to come and watch you or watch the club, and at Wimborne we're getting great crowds now, you know, it's... you've got to entertain these people. They're paying their hard-earned money. And if you don't entertain them, and there's many forms of entertainment, then they're going to stop coming. So as a footballer, I like to be thought as an entertainer. And the fact I then scored a goal and people are still watching it 25 years later, for me, is probably the perfect balance of that. Off the pitch, ultimately, you want your kids to look back on you with a smile. You know, I think that's all we leave behind is memories.
Yeah, 100%.
So that's what I like.
And lastly, what message do you hope to convey to those who've just listened to this?
I think this podcast is probably different to many others, because many other people have been successful and they're talking about how they were successful. I think in some ways there's a huge part of my life that hasn't been successful. And it doesn't define you. Failure doesn't define you. You know, it should, if you look at it in the right way, if you manage your emotions, it should help you grow.
Yeah.
And the reality is, it's a journey, isn't it, life? It's, you know, you're growing all the time. And if you think life's bad, then it can change. But generally it's a perception, and it's managing those emotions, and it's looking at some things in a different way. You know, sometimes you can look at something as a failure when actually it's just a lesson.
100%. Yeah.
You know, to manage those emotions so that they don't get on top of you. And that's all I've tried to do, and all I'll continue to do, hopefully.
Yeah.
And at the end, when it's the last checkout, then you can sit back and you can maybe make a judgment, and you can say, what was my life about?
Yeah.
But so while you're in it, you know, just keep going. And what's the saying? If you're going through hell, don't stop.
Absolutely. It's very true, isn't it? Yeah. Well, it's consistency wins the race, isn't it, ultimately?
Of course it is.
And if people want to connect with you, if the story has meant something to them, they want to come and check out what you're getting up to at Wimborne.
Yeah, listen, I'm the general manager at Wimborne Town. I'm invariably there every day.
Yeah.
You know, I'm probably one of the easiest people in the world to connect with. But yeah, my door's always open.
Amazing. Jimmy Glass, thank you very much.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, then screw it and just do it. Until next time.